Welcome to In the Hive, I'm Roger McDonough. You may have seen news reports in recent days and weeks about the fact that the Great Salt Lake is approaching, or, depending on who you ask, has already reached, its lowest ever recorded water level. And why does that matter? Well, researchers say that one reason you should be concerned is because as the water recedes and the lake bed is exposed, chemicals that are present there, like arsenic or mercury, could become airborne, that dust storms could throw those chemicals into the air that you breathe, and that could lead to a human health disaster. We're going to save that conversation about the shrinking Great Salt Lake for a future episode of this show, because today we're going to focus on the threat to the unique ecosystem itself posed by the disappearing water of the lake. The Great Salt Lake is the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere, and provides critical stopover habitat for millions of migratory birds every year. And those birds, right now, are in trouble because of the death of the body of water they are reliant on to sustain them. Mark Bell is a PhD student with Utah State University's Department of Wildland Resources. Along with his mentor, Dr. Michael Conover, Bell has studied the nesting and dietary habits of eared grebes, white pelicans, and other bird species that depend on the Great Salt Lake for their survival. And Mark Bell, thanks for being here.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course. I think people are generally aware of the Great Salt Lake as an avian habitat. I'm wondering, though, if you wouldn't mind giving us the sort of overview of the importance of the Great Salt Lake to birds. And, you know, maybe you could talk about the numbers of birds that are out there and how they use the lake in a broad sense before we delve deeper into this conversation.
Sure. So Great Salt Lake is really unique in the way that it's so saline. It's about three and a half times more saline than the ocean. And because of that, no fish are found in the lake. There's only two invertebrates that are commonly found out there. That is the brine shrimp and brine flies. And because there's no fish to eat them, they occur in huge abundances. And so there's this awesome food resource there, and it's kind of a unique little niche that these birds can use. The lake itself is typically most important for birds during the spring and the fall as a migration stopover point, as they're migrating north in the spring and then south in the fall.
Wow. And you said saline. I mean, obviously, we know that it's a salty lake. It's also a terminal lake. What does a terminal lake mean, and how does that play into why this lake is unique and special?
Yeah, so a terminal lake is a lake that has no outlet. The water does not flow out of it. It does not go farther to the ocean like other lakes we might be thinking, or even lakes around here that are freshwater. They have an outlet that then flows to lakes such as Great Salt Lake. And because no water flows out of it, all of the nutrients that travel downstream into the lake remain there. And then the water leaves through evaporation and leaves the salts and the nutrients behind. And so here in the Great Basin, we're in the middle of it here in Utah. And there's many terminal lakes and a lot of alkaline lakes and also saline lakes. And that's typically what we find throughout here, scattered along. Most of them are fairly small. Some of them, such as Sevier Lake, about 100 miles south of Great Salt Lake, it only occurs during really wet years, and then it dries up and is gone. It's not here every year. So that's kind of that's typical for terminal lakes. They can come and go. Great Salt Lake's unique that it's here all the time, and it is so big.
Yeah. You know, another thing that people are pretty aware of is the fact that the lake is imperiled. Why is the lake threatened, and where are we on the sort of scale of emergency? How bad is it today, I guess is what I mean, and what's driving that?
Well, I would say that there's two major drivers. One is public perception, and two is water use. So we as a public typically see salt water and salt lakes as wasted water. If the water makes it there, we can no longer use it for crops. We can no longer use it for culinary water. So in the past, especially, the water has been, it's been thought to use it before it goes down there and we lose it and can no longer use it for what we need. And then the second is, obviously, here in the West, water is a scarce resource. And many of the people around here established themselves historically through agriculture. And so there's a lot of ag use, as well as there's a booming population, and that is continuing to increase and projected to increase drastically in the next 50 years. And so there's a lot of water use that way. So we take the water out of the streams and the lakes before it makes it to Great Salt Lake, whether it's for culinary use or for agriculture. And in at least in the past, we've done so because we don't want to lose the water.
Yeah, because of the fact that we've, I guess, taken water upstream from the lake that's replenishing it, it's not getting down there. And so that's one sort of driver of the threat that we recognize.
Yeah, and that's the largest threat. There was a recent paper published by a gentleman named Wayne Wartzbaugh here at Utah State University. He is a professor emeritus, and he and some other colleagues published this paper where they made calculations, and they showed that the condition of the lake is almost exclusively connected to water use. Very little of what we're seeing right now is because of climate change. That is not, however, doesn't mean that it won't affect it. It just means that currently the lake was, when they published that paper, was about 11 feet below what it would be if people hadn't redirected the water and taken it. But now, of course, we're seeing other perils come in, which are low snowpack, very hot years. So that is going to start playing a role even more and more, and especially as populations are increasing and water demand is increasing in these areas too.
Let's go into the plight, the situation, I guess, for the birds on the lake. And, you know, a couple of examples that you are, I think, particularly qualified to talk about are eared grebes and white pelicans. I think there are other species of birds that you have studied out there, but maybe just to begin with, we can focus in on the eared grebes. This is a funny question, but can you remind our listeners, you know, what this bird looks like? Basically, the question is, what is an eared grebe, Mark Bell?
Yeah, so eared grebes are kind of a funny little bird that most people have probably seen out there, especially if they go out to any of the waterfowl management areas, or if they've been out to the lake, they will have seen an eared grebe, but maybe not known what it was and possibly mistaken it for a duck. They're a very small bird. They're between 300 and 500 grams on average, and they sit really low in the water, so you almost only see their head sticking up. But they've got these golden tufts on the side of their heads that kind of look like ears. That's where they get their name. They've got blood red eyes and a little short, pointy bill.
What is the drying up of the Great Salt Lake doing to the grebes? How is it impacting them?
Yeah, so as the lake level recedes, as the water, there's less water there, the solutes in the water condense and it becomes more saline. And as the salinity increases, the productivity of the brine shrimp, which is the primary food source for eared grebes, it decreases. Around 22%, the productivity starts to decrease. And then around 30% salinity, the brine shrimp no longer can reproduce via live births. So brine shrimp are really interesting in that they reproduce with live births, as well as they can reproduce using cysts. And so they'll produce these cysts, which have little to no value for the eared grebes nutritionally, but they can sit there dormant until conditions are right for them to then hatch and become brine shrimp. And so if the lake level or the salinity level gets too high, then the live births cease. There's no more live food for the birds. And eared grebes require approximately 23 to 27,000 brine shrimp a day in order to build up their mass and prepare for their fall migration. And so they have to constantly be pecking, about one a second almost, all waking hours of the day. They're constantly feeding. And so if these shrimp are not there, then that's their only food source. And so the major issue with the lake drying up is the rising salinity level.
Are we seeing that happening already to a certain extent, meaning a big decrease in brine shrimp and therefore a decrease in grebes?
Currently, we are doing okay. The Division of Wildlife Resources has a specific task force or a project. It's called the Great Salt Lake Ecosystem Project, and their job is to monitor the lake and keep it working well for birds, to manage it specifically for birds. And that group is in charge of monitoring the brine shrimp and the brine shrimp cyst harvest. And currently, the salinity level is okay, and the brine shrimp are still there and doing well. The salinity is probably in the realm of 16% right now. It's hard because as the lake level shrinks, some salts are left on the mudflats or the shore that's left behind. So not all of the solutes are collected into the water. So it's a hard thing to kind of calculate at what point we'll be in severe trouble.
I think that some listeners, as they hear this conversation, they'll say, well, why don't the birds just, you know, fly to another place where they can get food? Can you just talk about how thinking about that in that way is a little bit problematic?
Yeah, so there's a few things that I see problematic with that. The first being that the terminal lakes or the saline lakes available to the eared grebes here in the West are very limited. There's very few of them compared to other bodies of water. Places that will have the right salinity for the brine shrimp and the little competition for the food, those are limited, as well as just about every terminal lake in the West is having the same issue that Great Salt Lake is having. And so that's one issue. There's only a few other places that the birds can go to. But one of the big problems that Dr. Conover and I often worry about, or that we talked about in the book chapter that we published, is that when the grebes get to Great Salt Lake in the fall, they go through a molt, and so they can no longer fly. They're stuck on the lake, and these birds cannot walk. They cannot leave the lake at any point during this time when they've molted. And that just happens to coincide with the time of year when the lake level gets lowest, between August and November. So these birds are then stuck, flightless, unable to leave the lake when the lake has the possibility of increasing in salinity. So then there would be no food, millions of birds on the lake that can't leave. And so there's no way they could leave. And if they could, there's very few places that they could go to. And there's very few places that are big enough that could harbor that many birds.
God, and that's a really scary scenario you just described. I mean, it would, I guess, amount to carnage on the lake. I guess a question that I have on that same front is, do we know, like, are the eared grebes familiar with other, I guess maybe you can talk a little bit about the sort of evolutionary history, if you know it, of how long the eared grebes have been interacting with this lake. You know, if they've been coming for thousands of years, do they know anything else? I mean, it's sort of, I think that there is that sort of, well, there's other habitat out there, but isn't this just sort of like they know it's the lake that they go to? Can you talk about that at all? I don't even know how to describe this because I don't have the words for it.
Yeah, no, yeah. We've definitely thought of what you're talking about, so I definitely know where you're going. So as well as Great Salt Lake, there's another lake that's very common for the eared grebes to use. It's called Mono Lake in California. It's in Northern California. And Mono Lake historically was the lake that the majority of eared grebes went to in the fall. It's very small compared to Great Salt Lake. It's not near the size, but the majority of eared grebes in the western U.S. went to Mono Lake. But then it became unsuitable habitat because the city of L.A. would divert water from the tributaries and take the water before it reached the lake. So it became too saline, too alkaline for shrimp and brine flies and brine shrimp. And so the majority of the grebes have then shifted and now are on Great Salt Lake in the fall. It's estimated that 85% or greater of the total eared grebes are on Great Salt Lake in the fall. So we've got, you know, over 85% of this species all in one place. And they've been using these two lakes for thousands of years. I could venture to guess that they began using Great Salt Lake 10,000, 12,000 years ago when Lake Bonneville dried up, when it emptied, and the lake formed, when it first became saline enough to have brine shrimp. And then that's probably when the grebes started to use it. And it's likely that the birds have kind of gone from one lake to the other based on yearly cycles and drought cycles and things, which lake was better. But it's not something that, you know, a bird can just choose, oh, I think I'm going to go to Mono Lake this year, you know, or oh, Great Salt Lake sounds really nice this year. Let's go there. It doesn't quite work that way. It would probably take generations of the birds surviving going to one lake for them to, the majority of them, to start going to that lake.
Yeah, and it would seem that if a whole population of eared grebes in one fall dies off, obviously there's no choice about it. There are other species, of course, that are out there, you know, pelicans, phalaropes, is that the word?
Yep, that's correct.
Thanks for the pronunciation tip. I'm assuming that pelicans aren't eating brine shrimp, but are they equally threatened by the receding lake levels?
They are, for a completely different reason. So the pelican's nest, it's the second largest nesting colony in North America, is out on Gunnison Island, which is in the north arm of Great Salt Lake. We call it the north arm because it kind of protrudes up the top, but that arm of the lake is totally disconnected from the rest of the lake because of a railroad causeway that goes across. So that part of the lake is extremely saline. It's about 33%. There's no brine shrimp out there. There's not much of anything, just salt. Very few birds are even out there. But the pelicans still go to Gunnison Island, and that's their nesting colony. But then they can fly 100 miles, 150 miles to go forage. And they'll go across the Promontory Mountains, and they will forage at Bear River Migratory Bird Refuge, or the waterfowl management areas. There's areas in Farmington Bay, Ogden Bay, Salt Creek, Public Shooting Grounds, Howard Slough. There's a handful of areas here managed for birds. And the pelicans will come over here. They'll even go up into southern Idaho. They'll go down to Utah Lake and forage for fish. But then they will return to the island to feed their young, to nest, to take care of their young. And so the big issue for them is that this section of lake, the north arm, has no water inputs. So there's no inflows of fresh water into the lake besides a few springs. And so that level, it lowers and shrinks much faster than the rest of the lake, which then exposes Gunnison Island. Instead of being an island, it's now a peninsula. And so these predators, which before couldn't swim a mile and a half or a mile to get to the lake, you know, even if it was a half a mile, they can't swim that far. But as the lake shore gets closer and closer to the edge of the island, then all of a sudden they can make it out there. And for the past few years, we have seen very little productivity or successful nesting. Great Salt Lake Ecosystem Project goes out every year to band pelicans. They have some cameras out there, they call the Pelicam, that watches the nesting colony. And they couldn't go out last year because of COVID, but the year before they found very few young pelicans. Fortunately, pelicans are long-lived enough that they can miss a few years of breeding and still be okay because they're long-lived. They can then reproduce when conditions are good again. But when we see this prolonged for years on end, then all of a sudden there's a huge worry that there's no new pelicans to replace the ones that are then dying.
Yeah. You know, there are a lot of other species that are out there. We're talking about just a couple, the grebes and the pelicans right now. And I think we could have a somewhat analogous conversation about any number of other bird species. I'm wondering what we can do, what kind of choices we can make to maintain it or to restore it.
Yeah, one of the suggestions that Dr. Conover and I and many other people have made is that Great Salt Lake needs its own water rights. Here in the West, we divvy up our ability to use water. It's a legal right that someone has. It's a deed. It's a water right. And Great Salt Lake has none. So there is no water that is obligated to make it to the lake. By giving Great Salt Lake a water right, it would allow the water level to be held off at a certain level. And if this is the worst level we want it to get to, we can try and maintain it there at least. And this is what happened with Mono Lake. So Mono Lake became imperiled, but then the California courts system gave Mono Lake its own water right and mandated that the level had to stay at a certain level. But we don't have that here at Great Salt Lake. We just have a lot of people who don't like to talk about losing their ability to use their water.
Yeah. Where do these birds, the grebes and the pelicans, go when they're not at the Great Salt Lake? And I'm kind of wondering about, you know, there's a lot of different bird species out there. If you know, millions of birds that normally would end up traveling elsewhere, you know, hundreds, even thousands of miles, if they, because of the lake drying up, end up, you know, not surviving, what does that mean for those other places that they call home? So it's two questions in one. One is, where do these birds go? And if the Great Salt Lake ecosystem doesn't sustain them, what does that mean for the ecosystems where they normally also travel to?
Yeah, so I guess we could start off by saying grebes, eared grebes, start typically around the Gulf of California, northern Mexico. And they come up in the springtime around February. They'll stop at Great Salt Lake on their way up, but they'll fly up to where they're going to nest, which is typically in the northern U.S. and southern Canada. Those are the greatest areas for grebe nesting. And they'll stay there until about August, July or August. They'll fly down and they'll stay at Great Salt Lake until, or Mono Lake, if that's where they go to this year or that year. They stay there until November or December, sometimes into January, and then we'll fly down to the Gulf of California again. So they're in our area for a large portion of the year. And so if they weren't here or there, there would be the function that eared grebes play is they eat invertebrates and microinvertebrates. So if they weren't here to eat the invertebrates at Great Salt Lake, there wouldn't be much of a change. All we would see is that they would, the brine shrimp would explode in population, they would overgraze all of the algae in the lake, and then the population would collapse. And then they would produce cysts. And then when those cysts had the right conditions, they would hatch. And we'd just see that cycle constantly. Huge populations crash, huge, little. But other places, they play the role of eating invertebrates and keeping those invertebrates at the levels that we currently find them, which may not be a huge issue for us. We don't know all the impacts that could happen. But there's other birds like the pelicans. If the pelicans weren't around, they eat a lot of carp when carp are the right size. They feed on them a lot. They eat a lot of other fish. So we could see trophic cascades, you know, like these huge effects on what we see currently, the wildlife that we like to fish for or that we like to go watch, you know, bird watching, all of these things would be affected by losing these birds.
Yeah. Can I ask, I have two more questions for you and then I'll let you go. One is, I'm wondering how you feel about the, you know, the significant and ongoing impacts of humans on the ecosystems of our planet. Meaning, are you hopeful that, do you have any hope? I guess that's what I mean. Like, are we going to see a bunch of more extinctions and habitat loss and, you know, in the field that you're in, where you are researching bird species and how they interact with the world, do you feel that loss? Do you feel a sense of hopelessness, I guess?
Yeah, in my field, you very rarely hear anybody that has hope, because we're seeing all of these extinctions, habitat loss, all these big shifts happen all the time. So we rarely hear any messages of hope. I myself am optimistic. I think public perception is changing, and I think people are starting to wake up. We will see a lot more extinctions. We will continue to see a lot of habitat loss, but I think the perception is changing, and people are starting to realize that it's okay to still believe what I believe and think that it's okay to save the world too. It's not quite as out there of a thought to say, you know what, the environment's important. We're stewards of this. You know, we've caused these problems. It's okay for us to own up to it and try and reverse when we can and to help sustain what we have left. I'm optimistic in thinking that even though we are going to see a lot of other peril, we will see some good things happen, and we will see, you know, policymakers as well as the public shift towards trying to maintain and sustain the populations we have.
Wow. We've been talking a lot about water and the lack of water and the drying up of the lake, but I'm wondering if there are other threats extant. I mean, for the pelicans, the exposure of the land by the water drying up is a threat in and of itself. But are there other issues on the lake that are impacting these bird species in a significant way?
One of the unknowns that we have is that there's a lot of selenium and mercury, which are heavy metals. There's a lot of those in the lake and in the lake water. And those by themselves are known to cause reproductive harm for the birds. And, you know, they poison them. And there's been some connections with mercury levels or selenium levels of the birds and the birds that go down and don't make it. Because when they migrate from Great Salt Lake to the Gulf of California, they do in one night. They don't stop. They fly constantly. They start at the when the sun goes down, and they get there just before the sun comes up. And some of these birds will go down in Cedar City or St. George or other places. And they've noticed that birds that go down have elevated levels of selenium and mercury. So there's some of those concerns. But as of right now, for some reason, when those two are found together, they create some kind of a complex that doesn't allow the body to absorb them in a harmful way. So for now, we're okay. But if one of those becomes, you know, really elevated, it could then cause reproductive harm for the birds. It could cause them just to die. And we could lose populations to that as well.
Can I quickly ask what the source of the selenium and mercury is? I mean, maybe describe that for us.
So a lot of it is historic. Policies have been enacted to help curb the amount of selenium and mercury that are making it into the lake. There used to be a lot of mining tailings that were then washed into the lake, and they brought with them all of these heavy metals, or from sewage processing plants and just other waters, wastewaters essentially, that go downstream and make it to the lake. There's been a lot of work to try and curb this, and currently, like the mine tailings, the water runoff from that is held outside the lake. It does not make it to the lake. And so we aren't seeing a lot of increase in those currently. But once again, with the water level shifting, there it's really hard to predict where the concentrations are going to go or stay. And so there's a lot of unknown.
A lot of unknown. Mark Bell is a PhD student at Utah State University in the Department of Wildland Resources. Mark Bell, thank you once again for taking time to explain this to us. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm happy, and I hope the message gets out and people get excited to help protect the birds and to see the beauty there is. It's so fun to go out and see these birds, and we might as well enjoy them and keep them around for a long time.
What's your relationship to the Great Salt Lake and its ecosystem? How hopeful are you about the future of biological diversity in our region and around the globe? Email comments at kcbw.org with your thoughts, and we'll try to include them in a future show. Alternatively, you can record an audio comment on your smartphone and email it in. You can find a link to instructions on how to do that at this week's In the Hive show post. That does it for In the Hive here on KCPW, a listener-supported, entirely independent local public radio resource. Subscribe to our podcasts, and we've got other local shows you can subscribe to as well. Find them in your podcast feed or, again, over at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. Both Sides of the Aisle is coming up next.